So, recording, this is our Alaska History Project, and here we have Art Zimmer. Conversation. See what things were like back when. Art, could you tell us a little bit about where you came from before you came to Kodiak, before you came to Amalek?
Sure. I'll back up as of the time I got here, which was in June. 27th of 1963, on a DC-3, that was the old DNA airplanes that used to fly in here, very droney things. They now use them to fly through the interior. Have you heard about that? They give people tourist rides now, and they use the DC-3s to fly them to various parts of Alaska for sightseeing. I haven't gone on one, but they were very droney, but they got you here. That's how I first came in. But before that, I lived in Anchorage 1 year. I actually come from Canada. I'm still a Canadian citizen with a permanent immigrant visa in the U.S. I immigrated at Tope, Alaska in 1962, May 4th, port of entry there. The reason I came here, or the means by which I came, I was working in Fort Nelson, British Columbia, welding for a maintenance crew on a highway, gravel crushing outfit. I was their maintenance welder in the summer of 1964. And when one evening chose to go to a prayer meeting for 55 miles in. I was at mile 245, stationed there, and went into Fort Nelson, which is mile 300. And just to go to a prayer meeting, I desired to go to the Alliance Church up there. And at that time, met some people that came, stopped through from Anchorage, and they were operating Chapel by the Sea. And the man and his wife, their daughter, and they had another young lady with them. Carol, who was a secretary up there, worked in Anchorage, and lived with them there. And I admit she kind of got my interest a little bit, or I thought I was a bit interested in her. But I was interested in seeing Alaska. It always seemed like a romantic place to go to, a romantic idea, a place to go to. And so I asked them about the possibility and wrote to them, I think. In fact, I wrote Carol, I believe, through that contact. They arranged to have me come and said they were going to start a Bible school that fall or the next year, and that I might be able to work with them. I had finished a Bible school, 2 or 4 years in Canada, Prairie Bible Institute 3 years, and a year prior to that in Saskatchewan, what's now Nipawin Bible Institute, after my high school. And so I did arrange, and through their sponsorship as the Chapel by the Sea, they needed a U.S. sponsor for me to enter the country. And in those days, it wasn't very hard to enter. Now it's harder to get across, at least from a developed country. It isn't so hard for other countries. But I got my visa with their passport. And got in here, as I said, on the 4th of May of 62, and went there and lived there 1 year at the Chapel by the Sea, about 6 months. And after that, I went, got independent. I went welding downtown Anchorage, or an iron workshop, maintenance work, and supported myself. And then, come the summer of 63, I came down here. My purpose for coming here was to weld flotation tanks for Alvine's shipyard. But when I arrived, he had decided to purchase prefabricated tanks, floats, and so I instead went carpentering, and have done it ever since. Pete Olson, an old timer here that just passed away, he took me with him to a job site. The first thing we did was repair a windblown hangar right across from what was then the old air terminal, the airport, which is on the base roof, just beyond the present airport. The hangar building is no longer there, but at that time it gave me my first job. here. And then after that, I found a carpenter, which maybe I'll tell about later. But back in Canada, I was born there in 1936, which makes me this year 60. Just turned 60 on the second year. Anyhow, I was born to farm parents. They were having a difficult time getting a farm started. And in fact, when I was 3 weeks old, they moved to a whole new beginning, about 20 or 30 miles north of where I was born, central Manitoba. It was just more southwestern Manitoba. And we moved to an area called near Roblin, which is on the Highway 5 between Dauphin and Yorkton, Saskatchewan. Dauphin, Manitoba, Yorkton, which is northwest of Winnipeg, about 280 miles. And it was a rolling hills, some plains country, cold, very cold in the winter. And, anyway, I grew up there on the farm and took 8 grades of school in the grade school, 1-room schoolhouse, Shell Vale School. And we had one teacher for as many as 35 students, usually in high 20s, grades 1 through 8. And then I took 2 years of high school there, first, 9th and 10th, by correspondence. And it was also that's one of those teachers. In fact, she was a new teacher, a young teacher. That is, she hadn't taught much before. Shirley Sobus was her name. Anyway, she helped me with the tests and so on, but I otherwise pretty much tutored myself with correspondence, and that's how I got grades 9 and 10. And then went away to a Christian high school, Beth Nippon Bible Institute, which was then Two Rivers Bible Institute. It changed. They moved on. And that's where I finished high school, which was a very good school, and that's where I learned algebra from. I had a hard time starting. And I graduated at age about 18 with senior matriculation subjects all done. It was chemistry 1 and 2, physics 1 and 2, trigonometry, algebra, geometry, and the social studies, all the other stuff. Normally those. I took, one semester of typing and maybe one of piano. I can still play a little bit of piano, and I do my typing as much as I need, maybe 30 or 40 words a year. I have my own computer now, use once in a while, so I do my letters to the editor. I should say, backtracking just a little, from age 5 through 12, I attended a summer Bible school, which is in the same grade schoolhouse that we went to for day school in the winters through spring, and then in the summers, the school was vacant, and they allowed the Canadian Sunday School mission workers to use it for a week of full days or 2 weeks of half days of vacation Bible school. And it's a non-denominational Christian organization that works with children in rural parts of Canada, much like the American Sunday School Union does. And that was, with that I learned much of the scriptures, and I got my Bible base then, learned scripture verses and little songs about the Bible and such like. And I learned to love the scriptures. There was very much a desire to be the world. And that was a mile and a half south of the farm. The church we attended as a family was the St. John's Lutheran Church, a mile and a half north, also yet in the country. It was a big family group. Family church where it seemed like a lot of people. It was only about maybe 100 and some people, but to me it seemed more. But I was never as intrigued there with church life there as I was in the Vacation Bible School, where I, at age 11, was told that I could know my sins are forgiven as a group, we were told, and we need to sing a lie about it. We're going to learn a song about sins forgiven. And she says, you can stand by your desk silently and invite the Lord into your heart. She told us how, and we did. I did, please. another 2 years older, apparently didn't register with him, because 2 years later he got off the tractor on a field and he was convicted in his heart about needing to be a Christian. He got saved out there by himself. And that was following, there were some, among the Romanians east of our community, which ours was a German community, German speaking. In fact, I couldn't speak English when I started school at age 7. More German than English, very little English yet. But I learned it. And that Romanian settlement had a preacher come in by the name of Bill Wright from Africa. And he spoke a series of meetings, and that one night, I recall, he spoke on Isaiah 14:9, hell from beneath is moved to meet the anti-coming, a very powerful message. It was in a little log building. He could reach up and touch the log, ceiling joists. But all that was humble, but the message of God was well preached there, and it was that that stirred my brother to get saved. Anyhow, I can't get too detailed. But I went from that then to the Christian high school, after which I took a year of Bible school, graduated high school in 1954. It was in my 11th year, my 12th year, at about March 13th, my mother passed away, fairly young, age 48, of lupus sickness, swelled up and choked to death. My brother and her mom was present when she passed away. So I went home for that and saw my dad very broken hearted. It was at that time that I believe my dad got right with the Lord himself. Having always been a Lutheran, thinking that was the right way, he in fact expressed that. He says, but now I have the Lord in my heart. And now he passed away at 93, this February 10th. I was back home. And I remarked that to the Lutheran people, that they asked for comments by friends and relatives. I was able to tell them where I date back to my beginnings in spiritual, despite the fact that the Lutheran pastor said that he was saved in baptism. Anyway, my parents rather were moral, good upbringing people, brought us up in a good way, and certainly taught us how to work very hard, and loved us. We were five. I was the third of four boys, and then we had a sister after. We're all home then. Daddy passed away. So then, as I said earlier, I went west. I went to Prairie Bible Institute after the first year of Bible school in Saskatchewan. I went there for three more years and graduated in 1958 at Prairie Bible Institute with a pastor minor and a Christian education minor, and had some music subjects too. Quite a bit of missions was stressed, but the foundations of my belief and the thrust of my life, I think, was largely settled while at Prairie. Mr. Maxwell, the principal of that school for many years, affected my life perhaps more than anyone did. I still copy, listen to, and distribute messages of his on cassette tape recordings, such as The Born Again Life. I give that away quite often. Spirit-filled life. He was very sound in his teaching and moved me much, and I treasure that heritage on whole life. He in turn was affected by men like Stephen Olford, and was a great challenge to me as well. Alan Redpath, like this, and were challenges, and spoke in his conferences at Prairie Bible Institute School. So I have had a good heritage in that way. I did, though, break away from the Lutheran Church at age 14. After confirmation, I took that in German and English, and I was actually pushed away because I disagreed with their reason for baptism or communion. They said it was for salvation and for forgiveness of sin. I said no. And Jesus said it's the remembrance of me was the communion, and the baptism was an outward sign, expression of faith already in the heart, a conversion prior to baptism. That's what I re realized at age 14. I was later baptized as an adult at age 19 in the Nechaco River, an evangelical free church meeting in Prince George, British Columbia, where I had gone to work for a year and some before I went further north to Fort Nelson, where I stayed about a year and some. I worked as a welder on Finning Tractor Company for a while, a Caterpillar Company, various few places in British Columbia. And then went to Fort Nelson and actually went there to weld on oil rigs. I did some of that one there. And then did some little bit of construction. And from there I moved up to Alaska, where I, as I already said, began to. So that's kind of a backtrack way of telling you how it happened.
Well, when you arrived in Kodiak, you grew up in a country that was, well, I mean, in the farmland with pretty bold miners. When you first arrived in Kodiak, it was June 27 of 1960. Okay. What were your first impressions of Kodiak? It's an island. It's very different than where you grew up. What struck you?
Well, what I have quite a bit of a picture in my mind of first landing here and all. And Mr. Phillips had an old red, kind of a rusty looking red, orangey red carryall, and came to pick me up. I made prior arrangements from the Bible Chapel. He was pastor. That's Dave Phillips' dad. He was pastor here then. He met me, picked me up at the airport, and I remember bringing us around Dead Man's Curve, and I got the first view of town, and that was quite a made an impression on me to see the actual city of Kodiak as it was then. And I then came in and got acquainted with a few of the people there, and they had the old Bible Chapel, and now the Fish and Game building is across the Russian Orthodox Church. The Catholic Church was there, right across the street from the Orthodox, and further over where the Fish and Game building is where the Bible Chapel was. And the upper corner back toward town, like that block of land, was the Fisherman's Hall. That's where the Carpenters Union meetings used to be, and so all that got taken down. The Catholic Church got moved out to where their present place is. They use it as a thrift shop, their old building. And they built a new church building. But the Bible Chapel, I lived in, they had quarters there. There were some skid shacks attached and several young fellows. I think a few were in the Coast Guard maybe, or Navy then. And I, we shared some room in these places and helped around, kept the premises cleaned up and so on. We contributed toward the food. So the Phillips kind of lodged us, fed some of us, boarded, moved there, and paid. And then I went and set out on the job with Pete on this carpenter job. And let's see, the impressions are, I guess I was just not busy with life and didn't take too much note. I never did take too much note of what really happened on the water for quite a while. I didn't get on it for some few years. I did too. Maybe Phillips had boats and across. We went on a few outings. Just went across to Long Island or something, Woody Island. But life here, it seemed very busy to me, and industrial speaking, were busy with work. Pretty unloading. That was in, well, 63, all right. The winters are certainly milder, I found that, than where I came from. And I didn't mind that at all. Still, bitter. I did go at the Bible Chapel, the old one, I given an adult class shortly after I came and taught that for some years, an adult Sunday school Bible class. Led singing there for a number of years, maybe 10, some intermission. They had different ones at times came through. And was otherwise involved with college age youth. We used to have quite a few get togethers like that. Single group thing.
I do want to come.
I should say this of my impression. I remember hearing a cowbell when I worked for Chuck Idris after doing this. He did various house repairs and things, and he got me little jobs here and there. And actually, Chuck got me into contracting because the first building I did actually followed the earthquake the same summer as the earthquake, which was then the temporary jewelry store downtown for Mrs. Blankenberg, which then got moved out and is now the old beauty shop. Or it's the one that's built under the building. It's a two-story building across the beauty shop, Mobile Road, which is on the town end of the building that it's near Archer's there. Which building is it? There's various stores underneath. There's an apartment complex above it. Well, it's on the town end of that building. I forgot the name of that, but I built that building for $4,000, all material and all labor, including the electric and the plumbing and the roof. I took my first contract. I did that in the summer of 64, and it was Chuck who got me on. But when I used to work for Chuck, I needed some work at the Baptist Missionary, and I'd hear this cowbell always out there toward the ocean, and I wondered where are these cattle pastures at. I later found out these are buoys. Took a while.
But you've already mentioned several things that I want to make sure that we talk about. For one, clearly your connection with the church. The Bible Chapel in particular are very important. So I do want to come back to that. But I don't want to skip over the earthquake, which you kind of mentioned. And that occurred...
1964.
Less than a year after you've been here.
Right. Yeah.
And so, tell us about that. What happened?
The fall of 63, to find myself employment, I guess I got interested in self-employment. I found out that the Navy was disposing of warehouses, barracks, buildings. They wanted the sites cleaned up, and I was looking for something to do. So I found out you could sign a little contract. They had forms and stuff that you set up and pay a little deposit to guarantee removal of all the debris, but salvage lumber out of these. So I undertook, purchased a barracks, 30 by 70 or something like that, up in the hills there somewhere, in swampy acres right here. I brought past Edmundsburg on the way to the base. And that was more work than fun, or than money. But I managed to, I cleaned it all up, took it apart, salvaged what lumber I could. There wasn't much salvageable lumber really in those kind of things. But I did it and got it all done. In order to move the lumber, I needed a truck. So I looked around and found an old flatbed, 1940. Chevrolet, two-story, two-ton, and it had the frames, like tubular frames over, and it used to have a canvas top, and it used to be a military truck where they hauled their people, personnel in the back end, just back and forth, shuttled them. And I bought that for $200 from somewhere. I don't know where. I remember where I got it. Somebody owned it. But it worked, and I did some repair to it. And I used that to haul my lumber. I left the pipes over the head top, first the tarp off. It was not a dump truck, so I had to push all the lumber on and pull it all off, stack it wherever, and then found sales for it. And I think I was selling it, I think the market price around then was $200,000. It was a good first growth for lumber. 1x6, 2x8, 2x6, flooring, whatever it had under there. And then Ray Turner, a Coast Guardsman, and I went together and purchased two of their warehouses, which were 63 by 151 feet with a 10-foot wide dock on the long side. And two of those were right near the road that come around Dead Man's Curve toward the base. And the first clearing against the mountain was where the first one was, and the other one was just a few hundred yards further in. And so we undertook to take these apart. He'd help when he could, and it was for me a steady job taking this apart. And we paid a $500 deposit for each of the buildings. And but we were salvaging lumber, and we hired a little help to take the roof boards off. There's a lot of nail pulling work, 1x6s, 2-foot centers, and a nail down with 8-penny nails. There's a lot of pulling. So I remember hiring a few helpers. We'd pay them for the hour. But we were selling some of the lumber and doing all right. It had lots of. Well, the framing was 2x8, rafters, 20s and 14s, and the sheathing on, the double layer sheathing on the walls, 1x8s and 1x6s. 2x6 studs, and then the floor was where we made our money. That was decked with 2x6 tongue and groove, almost all vertical grain fir, straight, no knots almost at all, up to 22 feet long, 2x6 TMG. And then it was laid over 2x12s, and it was also all number one or two fir, 14 feet long, 1 foot centers, and they were laid over girders that were lapped 6 wide, 2x12s, 18 feet long. Well, that made our money when we started loading that stuff up and selling. And the canneries then were doing quite a bit of building, and they were a good market source for us. So we had the second building down, the floors were pretty well cleaned up, and I remember we had lumber on the dock and was loading this flatbed, another fellow I hired to help me. We were loading it when suddenly the earthquakes began to erupt. Backed against the dock, and I thought, this is going to be exciting. I'd like to watch something move. I heard the trees will wave back and forth quakes. I looked around and seen big enough trees around, powerful, so I didn't notice them close enough. But the sensation was that I was like on the dock was like standing on a skiff when the surf, somebody goes by, what do you call it, the wake goes by and it waves you up and down. And that's how it felt standing on that dock. And the truck was just bouncing back and forth, bumping against the dock. And so we asked each other, I wonder if they felt something like this in town. So we finished our loadout. We loaded up full with this lumber and drove to town. And we came around Dead Man's Curve. We saw a helicopter or two circling and boats circling around in the harbor, moving out to a base, and it just looked like something was wrong, and we didn't know, never dreamed that tidal waves accompany earthquakes, just didn't ever hear them. So we quite soon knew that people in town must have, something was happening to them. So we got to the hill just as you, above the boat harbor, as you come down toward town, and Ernie Mills was out there directing traffic. And he said, we've just had an earthquake tidal wave. We're about to have another one. Get up to high ground. I said, can I go through? He says, go. So I went through. And down through the middle of town, I noticed the streets were wet. And some of the sidewalks were kind of turned around where some of the little restaurants used to be. And the building or two I noticed as I drove through was dislodged out of place. So we went up and parked by the Griffin Memorial Building and began to watch the action. And by then the second wave was coming through, I guess. And that's the one that flooded the downtown, which we didn't see until the morning after, the next morning, that night. But we walked out there to see it. But we parked there and we watched the water movement rising fast through the channel. Pretty soon we saw boats drifting out into the channel, and then we saw buildings, I don't know, some of the houses, window deep, waving back and forth, just quietly floating out to sea. And the boats would be unmanned, circling around and bumping something once in a while, either each other or a house or something. It was also went out to sleep. It was an awesome, eerie, quiet sound, sight. You'd hear the creaking and the groaning of things, and all of a sudden a pop as the water would float stuff off their moorings. And that's when the Donnelly Atchison building, they had a big store right off the front. There was a piling pier straight off where now the ferry dock is. That's released. That's all been filled in now. They were down at the water level, and there was quite a big store complex there, industrial store. And all that floated away. When the wave was done, all he saw was the tops of was those stumps. Nothing else was there. They all floated out. So that was a weird thing. Tony Manley was a Marine friend of ours who he and I, at about 3 in the morning, we walked out. It was a very quiet, crisp night. The moon was out, and the night after the earthquake. And we walked down through, which is down Reznov Field, really, and where the rental store is now, Kodak Rental Service, that was a service station. Clark service station, and some people know where the water level was. It was right above the door line of the building, the tidal wave. Well, there were the old Salif fishing boat was deposited right at the base of that little hill, just against where the Cognac building is, or where now the Yukon office supply, or the office supply store. And it was left with a whole bunch of crab aboard, and they of course started to smell a few days later. And that one was then, they built the planking and blocks, and they rolled it, towed it on rollers all the way back and launched it a few days later back into the water. But there was quite a bit of salvage work happening. Boats were left on the shore of town. It was quite a mess down through town. It was just water damage that floated stuff high and then drop it down and leave it and turn it upside down.
So I imagine it was quite some time before Kodiak got itself put back together, and did you get in on some of that? Did you get to work on
it? Actually, the benefit, I guess, that came to me was we had a good market for our lumber. I remember after I brought that load of lumber through, actually, we unloaded it at Spruce Cape, where Pastor Phillips had his yard, and he said I could store it there. And Ray and I donated all the lumber for the Bible Chapel, the first 4,000 square feet, before the new edition now. But we donated all the floor joists and the decking that went on to a 16G. That was on my truck that load, that day. So that load across the tidal wave streets and is built into the church building.
So that's when the building was built, was
in 67. But the lumber was stored and then used there. But I thought then it was sort of a sense of depression came to me, that I felt like, boy, everything's over with, there just won't be any future for this place, and what's going to happen now? Everything was like a standstill. And it was. It seemed like that. Everybody was stunned. At least it seemed to me it was. And I think there were people who were, because you have to start to pick up the pieces and decide what are we going to do. And of course, Corps of Engineers came in and they did a lot of the erecting and reconstructing. And then SBA loans, 3% loans, came to town, financed a lot of the construction. So a lot of the old stuff downtown that was either no more or then was torn down and made room for all the new buildings. The bars are what thrive. These people that own these ships and Tony's and the other, they all built these good big complexes with no interest in them. So I guess the liquor industry didn't seem to suffer too badly. A little harder than everyone. But as to work it generated, we sold quite a bit of lumber. Then the canneries had suffered a lot of loss, and they were a pretty good market for us. We sold quite a bit of wood to them, and made our effort pay. So I did a house job for someone, an old house that put in for and received SBA money, saying that the earthquake damaged her house and really did do a lot. I saw that, but it was up to her. But she obtained money and hired me for a month or more to do the repair rebuilding work. So I think some people took advantage of it in some ways, but the town grew, and by 65, which is probably the peak year in king crab and shrimp, maybe, at least king crab and shrimp, both were very good industries at that time. But while I was, I guess it was in the summer of, maybe it was the spring of 65 when I did that jewelry store, I remember being downtown for about a month there doing that, and it was in September, I think. Possibly it was 63, I can't remember. But I was just amazed to see the kind of lifestyle I saw downtown. The drunkenness, the drinking, it was just blowing fast. These guys yelling and whooping, they were in for fishing and lots of money, and stuff was really turning them on. That impressed me quite a lot. The liquor, stuff, lifestyle, drinking lifestyle. But yeah, the town seemed to turn on. It came together pretty good. And there was a lot of pride in people saying, we will do build bigger and better. I remember then, it was hard to have people even acknowledge that God was in the universe. Didn't you generate any response to him or feeling or anything? Though, as we know, historically, in the Bible, almost any natural disaster is usually always linked to God speaking to people. And dealing with people to turn to him, it's usually provoked some response. But yeah, I saw little of that in Korea, very little conscience of that.
Since the earthquake, and I guess it's been 32 years since then. I guess I'm curious, are there any other events? I don't know necessarily to the magnitude of the earthquake, but any other events that you think have kind of shaped Kodiak's history significantly?
Say it wasn't the shake of the earthquake that damaged this town very much that I can tell. It was the water damage.
Right.
I just seen it as a more or less a steady economy. It has its highs and rate, you know, rises and falls of fishing seasons. That seems to affect the town. We had about a 15% drop in real estate values maybe 7 or 8 years ago. Whenever Anchorage took such a dip, they went down about 50%. Very low losses there. But it wasn't long before it went back up about 7 or 8%. And now it's close to par what it used to be at its peak before. But there was a time, I think in the late 60s or early 70s, when land values really did appreciate very fast. For instance, we bought land in Baranoff Heights for one lot for $7,000. It appraised at $26,000 or something on the sale after I built on just the land. And another two lots next to it, I bought the two lots for $8,500. And one of them was appraised for, I think, $26,000 or so, 24 cents. And the other one, was about $20,000. So, just an indication of it, just about 3 times, 4 times, 5 times as much. And that was pretty typical of land all around. So, people that purchased land then and sold it recently, or more recently, others have been fairly stable. The prices, at least, seem like in the last some years, 20 to 30,000 per building site, is pretty common, and still is. It used to be a lot less. But when I came here, fuel at the pumps was 22 cents a gallon, and then of course you remember when under Jimmy Carter everything was way up to $1 something. Might have been about the time when I got was checked. Can't really remember. But that was noticeable. Very noticeable.
Do you remember how high gas prices got here too?
How high? Probably higher than right now. It's $1.60 or so. Something prices here. We bought bulk fuel for most of the years I ever lived here. And buy about a 500 gallon tank. Have them filled on the yard. I used to buy my fuel for maybe 30 cents a gallon cheap. Have them when I needed it, right on the yard. Still do that. Anyone can do that. They have a place to put it.
Okay. I'm going to switch topics on you. Because I know that you were also involved in Kodiak Christian School. Your children went through the
Yeah.
And I just wanted to hear, were you in on the foundation of that school when it started?
Pretty much.
Tell me about the school, how it started.
I don't recall the years, what year, but it was an interest. My wife was a school teacher, Arlene, who I met here the summer of 63. I don't tell that story. And began dating the winter of 63, 64. And then we were married earthquake year, August of 7th, 1964. There were people here at that time, Mary and Fletcher Talkington, who was a tall old man from Florida, I think. But she was a school teacher also, a wonderful first grade teacher, very much loved by the school system here for a lot of years. And she always, and Arlene, had a burden to ever start a Christian school. And that's where the idea seemed to come from. Arlene taught here 3 years, taught first grade. She taught Brunei in 64. I guess she didn't teach the next year because December of 65, we had our first child. 2 years now. Yeah. So that's a few years back, and that was a grandchild. We formed a steering committee of local people, which I remember consisted of Woody Phillips was on it for a while at least. As sort of an advisor, and Chuck Mackey himself, and remember one or two others. And what we then did is began to inquire wherever we could to find out how to start a Christian school. And we were referred to Chuck Krapischitz, who was doing a good job administrating one up in Kenai, Cook Inlet Academy.
I'm going to make you pause so I can turn my tape over here. All right, tape turned over.
Okay. Sorry. During that time, we decided to visit several Christian schools. I was not on that team that went, of about four. I remember Chuck went, Arlene went, Woody Phillips went, and Kevin brought us to us. To Anchorage, and they visited about three schools. One was the Harvester School. I don't remember quite who the other one was. I believe they also went to see Cook Inlet Academy in Kenai, or Saldaha. And tried to get ideas of how they're operating and so on, and what to do and so on. We got ideas. And then Arlene and I went down to Seattle and were referred to Mount Lake Terrace Christian School, which had an elderly couple administrating it, had done for many years, the Atkinses. They were very good to us. Took a lot of time. He was like an old grandfather kind of person. But they could feel with us the burden and shared with us their hearts and how they were doing. They had a pretty good school going, including high school. Still operating, doing very well. And I remember them, after they'd share with us all the different things and how to establish a curriculum and all those kinds of things. Finally, he says, well, when you've done all your research and prepare to write a book on how to start a Christian school, if that fails, then just start. And it's about what we did. We started looking around for teachers. And with a lot of information we put together, and we found Mike Rosted, I believe, was our first one. I'm not certain, but I think he was. And we had Mike come, and we gave Mike, goodness, I think grades 4 through 8 or something like that. And he was administrator as well.
How many grades was the school?
I don't even remember. I don't remember if we started with the little grades then yet. May have, which I don't know. But actually, he did a pretty good job. He was very interesting. He had devotion for the kids and as well as the academic subjects, and he got them. They did good grades for them. Cuesta, our oldest, was then, I think, 4th grade. That's when she started, and she went through the 11th grade Christian school. The high school said once she took the years for by correspondence. After which the board decided not to have a high school. Mainly because there were not enough parents who had high school children. They did not want to use the tuitions from the additional tuition that may have been accrued from the lower grades to support and sponsor the higher grades. Despite the fact that the parents then of a group of maybe 6 or so high school kids that were eligible wanted to hire this teacher just to pay for it all themselves. Well, it still didn't want to be at that time, which I think was a failing mistake. I don't think you should start kids out and then turn them loose. I think those 4 years of high school are the terrific polishing years of all you put into them before that time. All the value base you lay, you can establish in those high school years and then turn them into a career search through their following education. I learned a lot in those years. I was on the board 9 years after the beginning of the Common Committee. I was chairman of the board for a while. But we looked at the Christian school conservatively in its finance management and all, and therefore we felt that we went to a number of the Christian school conferences that Association of Christian Schools International held in Seattle. As many as 1,400 delegates, teachers and delegates would come. Arlie and I went a number of years on our own, just to see and get feedback and information and possible leads to teachers and so on. And we'd bring information back, a lot of good information, and would supply it to the board members here. And they would often, very commonly, tell us that a 20-to-1 teacher-to-student ratio was what you need to survive the Christian school, because the funds are just not as plentiful there. Because the parents pay their taxes for public school and then have to pay private money for tuition as well. The school got started, and we actually, it went along quite well. And it began to grow, and did grow, and it's glad to see it's fairly stable now, about 90% of students. Our vision then and our purpose was to provide for a need that was here. And if there's a need for anyone's child to be educated in a Christian setting, we wanted to do it. That's why we chose to exist as a Christian school. difficult to get some of the Christian parents to believe in Christian school. They wanted us to influence the public school system as believers, they said. But when their children began to have distress in the public school system, and they were distressed with it, some of them became believers totally. Good to see that people did see the value of it. And when I was on the board, and Marlene too had a lot of influence, she was curriculum coordinator for quite some time, and she did a good job and a hard job searching out good curriculums, getting it to the teachers, getting it to the board rather. We like to see that the spectrum of learning is, it starts with God and ends with God. If all learning begins with God, if a child knows God, and you bring them to know the Lord, then they're free to learn all about the things He's put in the world. And then they pursue learning, and at the end of every spoke of learning, it's like a wheel of spokes, they would find in their search of learning God in it, whether it was in the social sciences or the other sciences or what. Hello? Yeah. Take it. So, I didn't say that quite as well as I'd like, but we were told at the Christian school conferences how to integrate the Bible into every facet of learning. And our desire, and Chuck Crouch has told us this a lot, he would come over and have many conferences with parents and show parents the value of Christian school, and that helped get the idea through the community. But they told us, and we believe, we have to establish a biblical worldview in the minds of children. And if so, then everything they learn, they'll learn with a view to making God known to people of the world. So they would also, for themselves, they'll find in the sciences, be it math or, physics or chemistry and all, they would see God's design in everything. And whether it's in the social sciences, they would see the purpose of God's influence or intervention in society, in the histories of society. And we felt like we have now the opportunity to introduce God into all the areas of learning where He really should be, because He provided the basis of all that. Rather than to have them learn all these things in a secular arena and exclude God. And so we found it was a very good opportunity, and still is a very good opportunity for all purposes. Academically, they did very well, too.
Okay. Those were really all the questions that I wanted to ask you. I just wanted to give you one last chance if there was anything else that you were just wanting me to ask about or share.
Well, historically, I think it's been said here there was always as many bars as churches in Kodiak. Maybe still. I think about 87% of the police activity is directed toward bar-related, drinking-related matters in town. I don't think I've ever heard of police having to take care of people from church because they were unruly, because they went to church. I have undertaken to write to the newspaper many years ago articles that would make people somewhat God conscious or Bible conscious, and I've been able to say quite a little. It was an opportunity that I chose, one of other things. I do personal evangelism whenever, and have been able to lead a number of people to Christ, people I've maybe never seen before or haven't seen before. Some elderly, God laid on my heart to go and minister to and witness to and let them. Bob Blair was one. He was dying of John, he was yellow jaundice, liver disease or something. I asked to see him, visited him one evening, 2 days before he passed away. so weak by that time. But he opened his eyes and looked at me and responded, and then he asked if he would do so. It was rewarding to me to be able to lead someone to Christ, which if I hadn't done, maybe they would never have done. And I challenge people to do that. And that to me has been a real joy. I probably preach more in my coveralls than in my suit, though I teach Sunday school. But that's been a real delight to me, to share Christ anywhere, everywhere, which has made me the object of criticism quite often, I know. But that doesn't matter. Used to take tickets from the passengers out on the train station platforms before they get aboard. I remember a story of a conductor that came around the people and they had their long coats on in the wintertime. And he says, "Tickets, please, tickets, please." And someone's remark says, "I bet he's not a very popular man this morning." And, "Oh, you're not." And they said to him, and he says, "Doesn't matter, it's the man up in the office window that I have to please." And I thought that's a real illustration. But I think I've learned to be a little more gracious with people and understanding. People need to keep their dignity. We need to save it and preserve it for them. And whether they believe wrong or right, it's still the thing they believe. But that doesn't mean you leave them alone. That means if you care for them. It says, "Let him know that he can either convert the sinner, shall save a soul from death, and how to hide a multitude of sins," says the book of James. And the Bible has been a very precious thing to me. One man in town once asked me, he's a good friend of mine, "I don't know for sure if he's a Christian. If he says he is, I don't know if he really knows the Lord or not. But," he said, "you must study books a lot for the building you do and the ideas you get." And I said, "Well, frankly, I don't." And I said, "Actually, I read the Bible a lot." And I said, "God just gives me ideas. I like to build a house a little bit different than just a square box." And I'm no professional builder, I just get it done. But I like to do things a bit differently. But it's true, you never lack for resource when you put the Word of God first. And I love the Scriptures, and it's been a wonderful book to me. I guess that's, to me, it is. Making money is not near as a delight, except what I do with it. And but sharing Christ is, really is. It's a reward to share the Lord with people, often on the business level. And some of my stories relate to people. I tell them how God dealt with me over some business thing. But if God isn't in a business deal, I don't like to do it either, because I can't expect his blessing. When he is, then I have confidence. And it's the work ethic is biblical, and I don't mind working hard. God rewards that. I also don't like to borrow much money or anything I don't have to. And that's also scripture. Because God described the people that walk in his ways as not being borrowers, but lenders. And I think that's the principle. And good to see when God works that out. So all we now do and have is pay the poor. You don't borrow. You don't need to borrow. And we have no debt. And we undertook early 70s we had a desire to build a base for missions giving. So the Lord laid the idea of rentals on my mind, my heart, used an audience. And then we proceeded to build rentals. And now we have 26 of those. And we're able to support ministries. I gave a missions report recently. Pauline writes out at least 14 checks a month to different ministries in different parts of the world, plus local givings and stuff. Maybe that's a good. But it's a joy. I always feel like I may not be giving. And yet God has met our needs. So that's worth saying.
I just want to say thank you very much. I had a wonderful time, so.